mend their constraint. And there are two possibilities. What is called the same cause, same event formula, or every event, some cause formula. And the reason I'm offer comes interested in the weaker of the two, namely, every event must have some cause. He doesn't think that by itself, the second analogy demonstrates same cause yields same effect. That is, the second analogy doesn't answer the problem of induction. How Kant would answer the problem of induction, I may talk about it. Whole complicated thing like the status of laws. Nor, given what I've just said about the Bode example, we now know that irreversibility is neither a criterion for nor does it entail causality. As Schopenhauer rightly pointed out, day does not cause night. Even though they are indeed irreversible. So the thought must, again, my regressive reading will argue, causality is an immediate necessary condition of objective succession. That is, my intention is going to be, as it is all along, that we begin with a piece of knowledge, in this case of objective succession, and we unpack its presuppositions. And I'm saying that when we examine what the intelligibility of the very idea of objective succession, we are committed to the idea of cause and effect. And Kant runs, as Watkins argues, two basic styles of argument throughout the text of the second analogy. And in the text of the second analogy, I wish I did, but after 30 years of reading it, I still don't have a way of mapping out the text. It just feels to me like he's just circling around it and trying to work at the problem, and kind of repeating himself in various ways, sometimes successfully, sometimes not. One form of argument that he continually brings up, which is on the whole not successful, is on your first sheet from Watkins, the sheet of two forms of argument. We'll just follow. This is a reconstruction of B 233.4. It's typical, and Kant tries the same strategy. This one? That one? The same strategy in the third analogy. So he says objective succession is a connection between two appearances. Intuition does not provide knowledge of any connection. Intuition does not provide knowledge of objective succession. The imagination synthesis can represent a connection. Objective succession is not just any connection, but a necessary connection, according to which one state of an object must precede a second state of the object. The imagination syntheses cannot represent a necessary connection between appearances, since it can represent only a contingent relation between perceptions. The imagination syntheses cannot represent objective succession. There is an exhaustive disjunction between sensibilities, intuitions, the imagination syntheses, and the understanding's categories. Only the categories can represent a necessary connection between the states of an object. The only category can represent a necessary connection between successive states of an object is that of causality. Causality is a necessary condition for representing and thus knowing objective succession. The analysis there simply turns on the limits of intuition. Intuition cannot show this, imagination cannot show this, yet we know it. So if we know it, and intuition can't show it, and the imagination can't show it, then it must come from somewhere. Well, it must come from the understanding, from the categories. Therefore, we're entitled simply because the understanding imposes it. And that just seems hopelessly thin. It's a by reductio ad absurdum of eliminating what faculties can do. So although it points us to the source of causality, the understanding, it doesn't really explain why that source is the necessary ground of that knowledge. The core argument is that something will count as objective succession if and only if it is subject to a rule, and it must be a rule of a certain kind, namely a rule that relates the condition to the condition. That is the causal dependence of successive states. And therefore, the crux of the argument is really what Watkins on the second side, he calls P4. P4 says any rule, that determines objective succession must include a relation of condition to conditions, that is, that of the causal dependence of successive states on a cause. So the claim is that there are real grounds that are responsible for the paucity of determinations. So Kant says, just to give you an example of this, at A 91, B236. Toward the end of that endless paragraph, passage that sounds a bit like something from the Transcendental Deduction. He says, since truth consists in the agreement of knowledge with its object, it will at once be seen that we can here inquire only regarding the formal conditions of empirical truth, and that appearance, in contradistinction to representations of apprehension, can be represented as an object distinct from them only if it stands under a rule which distinguishes it from every other apprehension and necessitates some particular mode of connection of the manifold. And then the sentence that states what's needed. The object is that in the appearance which contains the condition of this necessary rule of apprehension. The object is that in the appearance which contains the necessary rule of apprehension. How do you hear that?
What our name for it is, what the language, what how the object can be, or how we're conceiving it, or something. So you kind of press back to the end of it.
But what does he mean, the object is that which contains the rule?
Just, sort of laws, laws, I mean, maybe some sort of law of laws, I mean, I don't want to go that far, but I mean, but the object contains a certain, like the same way that the boat just moves down, there's something about the boat which is moving down. I mean.
So the thought is, of the object, right, that under certain conditions, namely water, such that water determines when in contact with, say, a dry throat, it will be slackened. So it's in the nature of the object that the rule is found. And the rule is the rule of that object determining successive states. So the idea is that what we're interested in is determinations of objects. Objects changing their determination from one state to another state. And Kant's claim is that a change or an alteration of state must have a ground. But more than a ground, it must have now a real ground. That is, a not merely a logical ground, That would be a preceding representation. That's no good. We're not going from representation to representation. What we're looking for in the representation, right, is the appearance. Appearances are just Kant's word for empirical object. And it's that rule in the appearance that will take us from one determination to another. So, temporal determinations in the second analogy are states of objects. That is, they're being in one state and then another state. So, the ground of the determination of states of objects are therefore going to be the causes of those states. But if all that's right, then causality is necessary for the temporal determination of objective succession. I bet you did that one too fast. So the first thing we're doing, right, is shifting from and away from the event ontology to an ontology in which, what, remember again, alterations are changes in the state of an object. So we're moving, so all change, so all succession is alteration, and all alteration is a change in the determinations of an object. So Kant says at A198, but immediately I perceive or assume that in this succession there is a relation to the preceding state. That is, immediately I presume that I'm perceiving an alteration, a change, from which the representation follows in conformity with a rule. I represent something as an event, as something that happens. That is to say, and now he's going to reinterpret what he means by event or something that happens. I apprehend an object to which I must ascribe a certain determinate position in time, a position which, in view of the preceding state, cannot be otherwise assigned. So, it's in the nature of the preceding state that the current state arises. And that is, the one is the, you know, that we're going to have a real ground or a rule taking us from one to the other. And that rule has a ground. But only in that way. Can I interpret objective, interpret a subjective succession as an objective succession? So the idea is that there must be a determinability to the order of events in order for the idea of objective succession. The only way we can have orderability is to have rules. But the kind of rules that will take us from one state of affairs to another just are causal rules. Therefore, causal rules are necessary for the determinability of the order of appearances as successive. Therefore, causality is necessary for the very possibility of temporal order at all. Let me, clearly, what's at stake here is the discovery of an order that is not up to me. That's part of what we mean by objective succession. And the idea of it being not up to me, that is, there's nothing I can do about it, that is, that the order is bound down, are all interconnected. So, the first thing I want to suggest, idea that we're interested in objective succession can only arise for beings that are agents. After all, we're trying to distinguish objective from subjective succession. And we're contrasting objective succession with subjective successions that are reversible. But the very idea of reversibility presupposes agency. That is, presupposes beings who are aware of themselves and their relationship to objects, and are therefore aware that they can reorder the order of their perceptions for certain ranges of objects. Therefore, the very idea of objective succession is part of the way in which we are becoming aware, or indeed we do become aware, of the limits of our powers to order the natural world. That is, it's our form of acknowledgement, our epistemic form of acknowledgement, that the order of the world is not up to us. So, if that's right, then it makes sense that what we're seeking out, or what we're doing when we're trying to interpret some subjective successions as objective successions, is we're trying to seek out the very way in which our powers are limited, which is to say the very ways in which the world determines its own order independently of us. Therefore, the kind of rules that are going to carry us from one state of affairs to another state of affairs, in the case of objective succession, are going to be rules that are object-dependent. Hence, when I suggest that what Kant's interested in here is showing that determinations of an object has a real and not merely a logical ground, as a ground in the world, and not merely in our way of talking about the world, then what we're looking for are the kinds of rules of interpretation that are going to allow us, or permit us, to acknowledge that power of the world's capacity, right, to determine the order of events. The notion of causality is precisely that kind of rule. So even if the notion of rule is as anthropocentric as anything could be, the notion of a causal rule is our way of sublating our own agency, if you wish, in order to articulate the limits of that agency with respect to the temporal order of events. So, that, yeah.
But is that agency please itself subject to the causality that it is?
And the answer is going to be yes and no. This is why so much hangs on the third antinomy. Third antinomy is not an accidental feature of this story, but at least let me give you one direct answer to your question. In one emphatic sense, the answer must be, in part, no, because, and I take this to be Kant's genius, because if I'm right, only a being capable of self-movement comprehend something as a causal sequence. So at least my thought is, anticipating where I was going to start next week, my thought is something like only for free self-determining agents can there be such a thing as causality. But not only that, for self-determining agents, they can only be agents if there's causality. Right? Given what I've just said. That is, I take it that the reason, why is, and it's always a great question, why is a set piece in a philosopher exemplary? You think of certain moments in Foucault, keep going back to it. Why? I think it's the right question for Foucault. You've really got to understand why the scene of torture and the scene, you know, what they're doing. In Kant's case, everything in a way does hang on the boat house structure, right? Because the idea sublimated within that analysis of reversible and non-reversible sequences is the relationship between freedom and causality. The house example is an example of our freedom. What is reversibility? But an awareness that not only that I, you know, and I take it that it has to be more than counterfactual, not only that I could have reversed the sequence, but that on occasion I do, right? So it's not like we're, you know, stuck with merely logical stuff. We have the counterfactual because we have the actual. So everything about the house example, which Schopenhauer took to be a mistake, I think is Kant's deepest insight, right? And of course, there's another kind of causal event going on between the house and my eyes, but that's dependent on myself changing. As Schopenhauer rightly puts it, on me moving my eyeball. Who's Vivian, our author. Conversely, now, right, I'm suggesting that the notion of causality is trying to get at what we mean by objective succession, of which irreversibility is an element. Right? And I'm suggesting that the notion of a causal rule, which has its real ground in the object, that is, it's in the nature of the thing, the water, that it in the nature of the water that as steam, when it hits the window pane, it liquefies. It's about the causal capacities of those two objects. And the notion of causal rule is exactly this way of beyond our power. But now I'm suggesting, and I'm going to make this literal next week, if beyond our power, then the power has got to be somewhere else. I can see you're looking at me puzzled. Let me relieve some of the puzzle for a moment. I am wanting to suggest that Kant thinks of objects as having powers. And that despite Molière, that the notion of power is not tautological. That is trying to get at features of objects. And Kant's commitment to this occurs in two remarkable passages at 8.204.5. Leaping way ahead, but sorry, two things out of order. Causality, he says, 8204, 8249. The paragraph that says causality leads to the concept of action. Causality, he says, leads to the concept of action. This, in turn, to the concept of force, and thereby to the concept of substance. He then says, I shouldn't talk about this, but I'm going to anyway. And then he carries on, but I must not leave the unconsidered the empirical criterion of a substance, insofar as substance appears to manifest itself not through permanence of appearance, but more adequately and easily through action. That is, what is a substance? I'm not going to answer what a substance is, he says. But I am going to tell you how we know about substances. We know about substances from what they do, what they bring about, what they effectuate. So what is it you want to know about water? Well, what you want to know is it's that which slackens the thirst, puts out the fire, makes the little tree grow. So maybe unclear about what the substance is, but he says we understand and comprehend substances from their actions. Wherever there is an action, he goes on to say, and therefore activity and force, there is also substance. It isn't substance alone that the seat of the fruitful source of appearances must be sought. So he says near the down about 15, 20 lines, for this reason, action, why this language of action? Action is a sufficient empirical criterion to establish substantiality of a subject without by requiring first to go in quest of its permanence through comparison of perceptions. So Kant has the thought this is what I'm claiming is the metaphysics of causality, obviously. I'm claiming that there's this whole analysis of the idea of there being a causal rule, the thing that Hume was worried about, is not free-floating. You don't get causal rules for nothing. You've got to have certain ontological commitments. And I'm suggesting that the nature of those ontological commitments in Kant are a commitment to the idea that determinations are determinations of something and it's no free-floating events, and that every change of a determination is something that is brought about, and that nothing can be brought about unless there is a real ground bringing it about. A real ground that is, I want to suggest, not reducible to any of the determinate states of affairs brought about. I'll come back to that next week. It's absolutely crucial to this whole argument that determinate states of affairs have indeterminate grounds. Underline that and remind me to make sure I fulfill that promise. Determinate states of affairs necessarily have temporally indeterminate grounds. So, again, why the thought, why this recurrence to action and force? Well, the recurrence to action and force, because, just not a quote on, there must be that in the object which provides the rule that will determine the order of succession of particular determinations. So he thinks that that's the, so he was awkward about talking about substance and action and force, but clearly he does so because he acknowledges that those are the ontological or metaphysical presuppositions for that notion of rule. So causal rules are rules of the powers of the determinations of substances. And they are rules, again, that precisely escape our power. Let's call them the world's power. Maybe we'll stop there with the world's power. This is, and I put one last word, this is Kant, the idealist. And I want to insist, only idealism can do this.